I want to start by taking you on a journey. In fact, the whole of our time together this evening, I want to take you on a journey, not one that you have to leave your seat to engage in, but nevertheless, I would like to take you on a journey. And this first journey, or first part of the journey, involves both time travel and geographical travel, because I want to take you back to the year 1623, and we want to visit the country of France. And in particular, we want to visit, in France, a town by the name of Clermont-Ferrand. And in that town, there lived a boy whose mother died when he was three. He was born in 1623. And he was taught at home by his father. And he's generally recognised to be one of the greatest brains that has probably ever lived in the course of human history. His name is Blaise Pascal. He never attended school. By the age of 11, he had worked out some of Euclid's propositions. I can only just say it, but he worked them out. Blaise Pascal devised the world's first calculator. He was also a man who wrote material that is fundamental to modern geometry. Blaise Pascal produced the theory of probability, leading to the modern studies in statistics and the modern science of statistics. He also made a massive contribution to the theories and science of hydrostatics and hydrodynamics and differential calculus. If that brings you out in a rash, well, I understand it. I remember sitting in maths at school and differential calculus was not my favourite thing. I can blame him. He also formulated what is known now as Pascal's Law, which is to do with the principle of liquid distribution, which is fundamental to all hydraulic operations. In addition to all of that, he died aged 40. And by no means did he promote scientific study in the whole of his life. There came a time in the life of Blaise Pascal when he really ditched scientific study, and instead he went in for religious meditation, and he thought on the great subject of God. He was a firm believer in the existence of God. He made no attempt, actually, in his thoughts. He made no attempt in his writings to prove the existence of God. But he argued like this, and I want you to listen to this, if you will, because there's a lot of other things that are going to spring from this. Blaise Pascal argued like this. He said, well, either God exists or he does not. Then he went on to say this, that reason alone is incapable of settling the question. Then he went on to state this as a further proposition. He said that unbelievers cannot criticize Christians for having no rational grounds of belief when unbelievers, that is, those who do not believe in the existence of God, have no ground for their own belief. And so what Pascal did was this. He said, look, this question of the existence or the non-existence of God is actually so important that sitting on the fence in relation to the matter is not a sensible thing to do, not a sensible option. Now, a whole lot of you tonight, I don't know, some of you I know, some of you I don't know, so I don't know from the very start where all of you are coming from in terms of what you believe relative to the existence or non-existence of God and the things that flow from that. It may be that you're here tonight because you think that really people who argue for the existence of God have lost a few marbles, and maybe the majority of their marbles have gone and disappeared. But you see, some might say, well, it doesn't really matter. After all, it's a sort of a metaphysical question that has absolutely no relevance for modern man, and that in the year 2006 it surely hardly matters whether God exists or not. But what Pascal was saying was this, and which I want to urge upon us. He says the question is so important that sitting on the fence relative to the matter is actually not an option that any one of us has. This has been put in another way. It's been said that in many areas of life, the acceptance or non-acceptance of certain hypotheses is not at all critical. But the question of the existence or the non-existence of God is a living question. It is actually forced upon us. It's a question of such momentous proportions that we cannot escape it. It is, in fact, the issue that is greater than all issues. It's the question that is bigger than every other question. And what we can say tonight is this, that our whole view of everything depends on where we stand in relation to this question as to whether or not God exists. I didn't really know whether to go on to say this next bit, but seeing as we're in Toaster, I will. Blaise Pascal went on to make his famous wager. It is known as Pascal's wager. I hesitate to mention it because I wouldn't want anybody to go away in this town of Toaster, of all places, thinking that putting wagers on anything is really very good. Least of all do I really think that we wager on whether or not God exists. Nevertheless, Pascal did say this. He says, let's weigh up the gain and the loss in wagering that God is. He says, let's estimate these two chances. If you win, you win everything. And what he said is this, if you lose, you lose nothing. That is to say, if it is that a person believes that God exists, the doorway is open for a person to win everything, he or she loses nothing. If in fact a person wagers, if a person believes that God doesn't exist, they close the door, and through the non-belief in the existence of God, the possibility is greatly enhanced that, if that belief persists, that you actually lose everything that there is to lose by otherwise believing in God. Pascal. Well, he believed in the existence of God. All I'm saying to you is this. He was one of the greatest minds that ever lived. And what he said was this. That it's such an important question that we cannot really sit on the fence regarding it. Our modern world is a world, as you will know, in which science rules okay. And many scientists say this. And they say, there's no further need for faith. This is what they say, that science has actually made God redundant. Or at best, mythical. I remember my first RE teacher at the grammar school that I went to. And I remember the first lesson she came in, she says, now boys, she says, the first thing we're going to learn is this, that the Bible is a book of myths and legends. And particularly the book of Genesis, she said, at the very beginning of the Bible, she says, I want you all just to remember that actually it's a book of myths and legends. And her view was this, that science has made God redundant. That science has put God into the realm of mythology and Hogwarts. And, well, she didn't say Hogwarts, because Hogwarts didn't exist all those years ago. But that's really what she would say if she came into a class of school children just now. And, say many scientists, look, science contradicts the Bible. Therefore, the Bible is untrue. Listen, if you will, to some of these immodest claims. You might think them arrogant claims, actually, that certain people have made relative to this particular thing. Listen to the philosopher Bertrand Russell, long since dead. But listen to what Bertrand Russell had to say on this particular point. He said that whatever knowledge is attainable must be attained by scientific means. And he said, what science cannot discover, man cannot know. Well, I think that's immodest. You may think that's immodest too. You may think there's not just too much humility in Bertrand Russell when he said that. Can I remind you? He said, whatever knowledge is attainable must be attained by scientific means. And what science cannot discover, man cannot know. Not that he could prove that scientifically, of course. And then, can I just remind you of something that's been stated by Richard Dawkins? He's the Simonia Professor for the Public Understanding of Science at Oxford University. He is, of course, a modern guru of atheism and evolutionary thinking. And Richard Dawkins has said this. He said that religion is no longer a serious candidate in the field of explanation. He said it is completely superseded by science. Then also at Oxford University there is another lecturer by the name of Peter Atkins. And what Peter Atkins is on record as saying is this. He says there is no necessity for God because science can explain everything. So I'm putting to you this, that the claims of such people actually are grossly immodest. Actually, I think we could say they really are arrogant claims, which say that science rules, okay. And here are top people in their fields of philosophy and science, and these are the kinds of things that they're saying. And you know, as well as I know, that they're thrown out at the population at large, churned out by the BBC and other media outlets who are the big opinion formers in our day and generation. And such opinions are therefore widely accepted as fact. But tonight, I want to challenge those views. I want to challenge those opinions. I want to challenge those immodest claims. And I want to submit to you this evening that the realities of our present existence, which are observable to the eye and known in the heart, point to the existence of a supreme and eternal being, whom we are happy to call God. And in doing so, there's various places that I wish to take you in your thinking. Now, I hope you haven't had too busy a day, because I, you know, sometimes you can sit in a semi-comfortable seat and in a semi-warm atmosphere, and you can begin to feel a bit sleepy after a busy day. But I want to ask you, if you'd be so kind, as to try to really think through some of the matters that I want to bring before you. Now, we're actually going to London, in our thinking, and we're going to London, not that you might expect to find God in the streets of London. Well, you might do. Plenty of people have, I suppose, but I want to go to London because there's various places that we want to visit in London. Couple of places anyway, but before we go, there are certain preparations that we'll need to do. And you know, and I know, that before all of us came out tonight, we actually looked in the mirror. So the first place that I want to stop in our journeys is this. I want us all to look in the mirror. Now, some of you might not like looking in the mirror. I understand that. This year I had a big birthday. The beginning of January I had a big birthday. And see, the thing is, when I look in the mirror, I see a whole lot of things now that I never used to see when I look in the mirror. So I don't know what you think when you look in the mirror, but let me just tell you this. Evolutionists would have us believe this, that actually when you look in the mirror, you see nothing more than a piece of slime. Now, I want you to that to sink in to all of our hearts and heads. This is what Peter Atkins at Oxford said. He said, mankind is just a bit of slime on the planet. He's an atheist. He's an evolutionist. He says, mankind is just a bit of slime on the planet. So as we look in the mirror, if it is that we have an atheistic and an evolutionary mindset, we'll just need to remember this, that the logical outcome of such thinking is, you really ought to agree with Peter Atkins, that actually you're not a lot more, if anything more, than a piece of slime. Well, I want to put to you, that's not true to the reality of our experience. Or further, if you look in the mirror, remember this, Richard Dawkins says that human beings are nothing more than jumped up apes. So I suppose we can conclude that atheistic evolutionists are not likely to be very flattering to us. And I can only hope that these two men say a whole lot better things to their wives than they're saying to us in the books that they've written. And so we want to look in the mirror. What do you see, actually, when you look in the mirror? You might not like what you see, but as you look in the mirror, what you're seeing is this. You are seeing the most remarkable thing on the planet. I mean, that's a thing that every one of us tonight can really rejoice in. That there's nothing more marvellous in the whole of the planet than you. Mind you, it does apply to us all. I want you to think for a moment of your eye that you're looking through. We're told that the eye handles 500,000 messages all at once. And it does so through the tiny retina in the eye, in which there are 124 million rod-shaped cells, and a further 6 million cone-shaped cells, and these are there in the tiny retina of your eye and mine. The 124 million rod-shaped cells are to distinguish light and darkness. The 6 million cone-shaped cells are to distinguish colour. So here we are tonight looking at each other, but I want you to think you're looking in the mirror, and as you look in the mirror, what you're seeing through your eye is the most remarkable thing on the whole of the planet, and you're doing it through these 130 million things in your retina. If you spend too long in front of the mirror, someone might call you, which might cause you to look at your ears. You might not like your ears. I'm not too keen on mine. And I've met a whole lot of people that don't like their ears. But the ear is the most remarkable thing. The ear, somebody has likened it like this. If you were to liken the ear to a grand piano, there are in it 24,000 strings and 2,000 keys to assist in the hearing mechanism that there is there in our skull. Here is our hand. There are apparently in the order of 650 million nerve endings in our hands. And it's been described as the most precise instrument in the world. Your hand. You can't hardly look at your heart in the mirror, but you certainly can look at the effect of your heart beating in the mirror. And the heart is a most remarkable thing. It beats somewhere in the order of 100,000 times per day. In our heart and in our body, there are 80,000 miles of blood vessels. In addition, cells of blood travel an accumulated daily distance of 168 million miles. There's your heart beating away. You probably think nothing of it most of the time, but there it is. What about if you were to cut your finger, say, before you were looking in that mirror, and there's a drop of blood on the end of your finger, and you say, well, a drop of blood really isn't very much at all. But think again. One drop of blood contains 250 million cells. And each of those cells contains literally thousands of different substances. Then, I want you to think of your brain. Called by Isaac Asimov, the most complex and orderly aggregation of matter in the universe. Can I repeat that to you? He says the most complex and orderly aggregate of matter in the universe. In our brains, there are more or less 100 billion nerve cells. And each of these has between 10 and 100,000 connectors to other cells. You'll understand that the brain is something wonderful indeed. Little wonder that he called it the most complex and orderly arrangement of matter in the universe. What about your skin? You look in the mirror and you see your skin, and you might see signs of this and that as you look in the mirror and think about your skin. But just remember this, that your skin has been described as three integrated layers of waterproofing, including a sophisticated air conditioning system. It has 6 miles of ducts. And these ducts are a fifth of an inch long, allowing water to escape when we sweat, but not allowing water to ingress, to enter the body. Actually, the skin, you won't like this bit, but the skin supports 6 million organisms. Lots of creepy crawlies all over you all. You don't see them in the mirror, and you might be glad that you don't. Nevertheless, they are there. Now think about the human cell. One cell in the human body. There are, by the way, 100,000 billion cells in the human body. 250 million, as I say, in one drop of blood. When Darwin formulated his theory of evolution, which was published in 1859, a very interesting year, by the way, when Darwin published The Origin of Species in 1859, the idea was that a single cell was a very simple thing. But let me tell you what Richard Dawkins says about one cell in the human body. He says that the nucleus of a cell contains a digitally coded database larger in information than all the volumes of the Encyclopedia Britannica put together. Did you catch that? That is a most remarkable thing. The nucleus of every cell in your body, and there are 100,000 billion of them in each of our bodies, give or take. Every single one of them, the nucleus, has this coded database, which is larger in information content than all 30 volumes of the Encyclopedia Britannica. Michael Denton, a writer on these matters, has said this. He says, if we were to magnify a single cell 1,000 million times until it was 20 kilometres in diameter, he says we'd see an object resembling an immense automated factory carrying out as many unique functions as all the manufacturing activities of man on Earth, all tucked away in a cell so small that you couldn't possibly see it with the naked eye. Michael Behe, an American microbiologist, has put it like this, that you can liken the cell, one cell in the body, to a complicated city with all the different things that are going on in a city at any one time. He says you can liken the single, so-called simple, at one time called simple, cell in the human body to a massive city. There are so many things going on in that one cell at the one time. And as you look in the mirror, and you look at your eyes, and you think of your ears, and you look at your hands, and you think of your skin, and you see your heart beating, and you consider that it's the brain that's making everything all work in your body, as you think about all those matters that I've just put before you, there must be a question that arises. And the question that must arise in all of our minds is this: could this really be by chance? Now that's a very searching question. Could this really all be by chance? Dawkins says this. Atheism and evolution must say this. He says that we live in a world in which there is no design, no purpose, no evil, and no good. Nothing but blind, pitiless indifference. What's he saying? He's saying that we human beings are here just as a result of atheism and evolutionism. That evolutionism demands that that is all that it is. Blind chance, purposeless matter, plus time, plus time, plus time, plus time, plus more time, plus more chance, plus more matter, plus more time, plus more time. In fact, more time than you can begin to even imagine would ever be possible for the length of time that our universe has existed. And so, faced with the complexities of design, of course, people consider the whole thing about theories of our origins. And two theories of our origins, which are widely assumed to be factual. I was reading just this week about a certain... In fact, I was in Otterker's bookshop in my hometown yesterday. And I was looking at a book in which a man was speaking about the Big Bang. And as he's speaking about the Big Bang, he's speaking about it as fact rather than theory. But can I just remind us all that in actual fact, the theory of the Big Bang as the main theory that is postulated in our present world for the beginning of the existence of everything that there is actually only a theory. What it says is this. It says that something like, well, multitudes of years ago, The predictions vary depending on who you listen to. But multitudes and multitudes of years ago, all that our universe contained was found in a tiny speck. That tiny speck was very hot, it was very dense, and it was very small. But in 1,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000, size of a football. And that beyond that, it expanded at an incredible rate, and it has been expanding ever since. So the theory of the Big Bang as the origin of our universe says that's what it was. A speck that in that fraction of time that is impossible to imagine, it expanded enormously from what it was, and it exploded ever since. It's been enlarging ever since, so that we are living in a universe that is an ever-expanding universe, according to Big Bang theory. But the question I'm putting to you tonight is this. What kind of explanation is that for anything? I put this question to you, first of all, where did the speck come from? Well, the atheist says it was just there. I mean, highly convenient to say, well, it was just there. But the question that must be asked is this, how was it there, if indeed it was? And why was it there, if indeed it was? And it leads us to one of the great fundamental questions for our thinking, which is this, why is there something rather than nothing? Why is there something rather than nothing? Listen to what Peter Atkins at Oxford says. He says that the whole universe is an elaborate rearrangement of nothing. Astonishing. I just put it to you that that is a totally astonishing statement. The whole universe is an elaborate rearrangement of nothing. An old Latin maxim, translated into English, says this, that out of nothing, nothing comes. Then we can also say this about the Big Bang theory and the fact that it's only a theory. Even controlled explosions cause disorder. The atheist, of course, says that the universe was started by this unplanned, unguided, accidental, purposeless, meaningless explosion, this detonation. And yet, remarkably, the physicist finds this, that the universe, the world in which we live, is governed by universal laws that you can depend on, by universal laws that are dependable. Yes? Could it all really be a series of flukes? That we're all here, with the first massive fluke being the Big Bang? Sir Fred Hoyle was famous in scientific circles. I see, by the way, there's a book on the bookstall that nicks its title from what Sir Fred Hoyle once famously said. He was speaking about the possibilities of animate life coming from the result of the Big Bang. He said that to say that animate life could come from the result of the Big Bang was of the same magnitude of likelihood as when a hurricane blows over a junkyard that it should produce a jumbo jet. He says there's as much chance in a hurricane blowing over a junkyard and producing a jumbo jet than there is for animate and organized life to arise from the Big Bang. But can I remind you of this? We couldn't actually survive if the Earth was 10% larger or smaller. We couldn't actually survive if it was very slightly nearer or further from the sun. We couldn't survive if it didn't spin once in 24 hours. Neither could we survive if the Earth was not tilted at 23.45 degrees. And further, we couldn't survive if the ozone layer was only slightly thinner, which is why there's all the worries about the ozone layer. Could that all be by chance? That all came into existence out of nothing, so to speak? At least a tiny speck, though we don't know where the speck came from. Massive explosion. Explosions always cause disorder. Even controlled explosions do that. We are being asked to think that this world in which we live, with its precise positions relative to the sun and the moon and the galaxies and so on, we are being asked to believe that it was all by chance. And further, in addition to Big Bang, for this universe in which we live, we're of course well aware of the theory of evolution. I want to remind you tonight, if I may, that there is an embarrassing lack of evidence on which the evolutionists support their theory. I was reading an article in the Times newspaper a little while ago, and I was very interested to see this, that if I may quote Richard Dawkins again, he's not going to be quoted all night, but he's a very interesting person to read. He says this about evolution. He says, "I cannot prove it, but I believe it." Let me quote to you Francis Crick. Crick and Watson discovered DNA back in the 50s. Francis Crick was an atheist. He was a person who believed there was nothing other than that which was material. And Francis Crick said this, that an honest man, armed with all the information available to us now, could only state in some sense that the origin of life appears at the moment to be almost a miracle. So many are the conditions which would have to be satisfied to get it going. Now, that's quite remarkable. Listen again to what he says. He refuses to believe in God. This is what he says. That it seems that the origin of life appears at the moment to be almost a miracle. So many are the conditions which would have to be satisfied to get it going. And it seems to me, therefore, that these people, whose theories we are asked to believe, are atheists first and scientists second. Now, it isn't commonly said, but this appears to be the case, that generally speaking, evolutionists start with the axiom of materialism. Now, let me just explain to you what that means. Professor Richard Lewontin said this: "We take the side of science. in spite of the patent absurdity of some of its constructs, in spite of its failure to fulfil its many promises of health and life, in spite of the tolerance of the scientific community for unsubstantiated just-so stories. He says we take the side of science because we have a prior commitment to materialism. In other words, what these leading people in the realm of evolution are saying, and atheism are saying, that whatever we discover, whatever evidence we think we have for whatever theory we postulate, there is one thing that we cannot admit, we will not admit, the existence of anything other than that which is material. We will not therefore accept that there might be a God. There will not be accepted by us any possibility of the supernatural. And Lewontin goes on to say this, moreover, that materialism is an absolute, for we cannot allow a divine foot in the door. So I want us to just consider that before we just move on a bit. So much for scientific objectivity. It is pumped out to us that science is objective from beginning to end. I submit to you that's not the case. And that so many people who want us to believe in evolution and in the Big Bang and in a purposeless, designerless universe, so many of these actually come with a prior commitment to naturalistic explanations for absolutely everything that there is. Anyway, the evidence, there's an embarrassing lack of evidence. If you don't believe me, listen to another evolutionist. Her name is Lynn Margulis, a professor in the geosciences department of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology in the United States. She's not a small player in the field. She believes in evolution, but not common Darwinism or neo-Darwinism. She believes in a theory called punctuated equilibrium. You see, she looks at the fossil evidence and she sees the fossil evidence doesn't stack up. So what she sees is this, that there were sudden bursts in the evolutionary cycle. And there was a sudden, in these sudden bursts, there was a massive change in species, and one species developed into another. She actually lectures some of the world's leading scientists. And this is what she asks them. She says, is there anybody here who has any unambiguous evidence for evolution? Now remember, these are people who would give their back teeth to prove it if only they could. These are people who spend billions of pounds on research, of research budgets, to discover, if they can, the thing that will prove evolution. She asked them this question. Is there anyone present who has any unambiguous evidence for evolution? And the answer is this, a complete and utter silence. So that we see this. There are no transitional forms between invertebrates and vertebrates, between fish and amphibians, between amphibians and reptiles, reptiles to mammals, apes or primates to man. There are absolutely no transitional forms. Actually, very interesting. I was listening to the news on the radio at tea time yesterday, Thursday. And in Canada, paleontologists, I think, and others have discovered what they think is a missing link. You know, a fish that was somewhere between a fish and a reptile. This was a fish with stumpy legs. Well, watch this space. But you see, the thing they say is this. Look, this is the missing link. But dear friends, between one species and another, if there was to be evolution from one species to another, one kind to another, there would have to be literally millions of missing links. All one bit added on from the previous. Well, they come up with a fish with stumpy legs. Watch that space, by the way, because soon enough, I rather guess that fish is going to become something incredibly different. Well, here we are. We look in the mirror. We say to ourselves, that's a fantastic thing in the mirror. We look in the mirror and we say, no, Peter Atkins must be wrong. We can't possibly be just a piece of slime. We know too much about ourselves for that. We look in the mirror and say, could such an incredible piece of design actually come about by mere chance and purposeless matter, and time and time and time and time and time? Or will we say, in the words of the psalmist in Psalm 139, he spoke to God and said, I will praise thee, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Now, we're getting on the train from Toaster, and we're heading down to London. And we spent a long time in front of that mirror. I hope all of you spend a little less time in front of the mirror than we have just done before you go out. Well, we're on the train to London, and we're getting to London, and we're going to call in another place. And that place that we're going to visit just now is the Tate Modern. And in the Tate Modern, we're going to go into a room in which there is a large canvas. I'm not quite sure what to describe this thing, so I'm going to call it a canvas. I think it's canvas anyway, perhaps it's some other material, but there it is, it's on the wall, you see. And this thing that we're looking at in the Tate Modern, it's not a constable, you understand. It's not the Dedham Vale or anything like that by constable, in which there's a clear picture of a beautiful English rural and rustic countryside. No. Now, we're looking at this thing on the wall, and it's called Yellow Islands. And it's a painting, if that's what you call it. It's a painting, it's a work that's done by an artist, if that's what he is, by the name of Jackson Pollock. Now, let me tell you how he did it. He put the canvas on the floor. And he positioned himself in the space of the canvas. I think that means he stood on it. At least, or he might have been above it, but he was in the space that was occupied by the canvas. As he stood there, he trailed and dripped paint onto this canvas. The blurb at the Tate Modern says this: he dripped and trailed it onto this canvas in a complex substructure. I think if we looked at it, we'd probably think that for complex substructure, read total mess. He then got a brush with yellow paint on it, and he applied brush marks with his yellow paintbrush. And then while the canvas was still wet with the paint, he got the canvas and lifted it up. He tilted it at an angle, allowing the still wet paint to sag and run. Now, I haven't made that up. That's from the Tate Modern website. Yellow Islands by Jackson Pollock. Have a look at it for yourself. It's astonishing. Well, as we look at this, and there's the curator, or whatever they call the person in the Tate Modern. I don't suppose they call him the curator. But anyway, here's an assistant in this room where this canvas is. And we say to the assistant, excuse me, this is really a very remarkable picture. Would you be so kind as to tell me the meaning of this picture? Well, this assistant would look at us and say, meaning? What century do you live in? Meaning? They say, my dear man, my dear woman, that this actually doesn't have any meaning. This assistant might tell us what the artist, so-called, said relative to this painting. He said, when I'm painting, I am not much aware of what is taking place. Well, if he wasn't aware of what was taking place, I don't suppose we're going to be aware of what it actually is. Actually, it's nothing. This is a completely random piece of work. It might qualify for an Arts Council grant in due course, but this is completely random. This is absurd in every meaning of the word. It is an absurd piece of work. It is something that has no purpose. It has no meaning. There is nothing at all that we can take away from that painting except for this. You can take away what you like from that painting. You see, I might look at that picture, Yellow Islands by Jackson Pollock, and you might be standing by me, and you say to me, what do you see in that? Well, trying not to be cynical at all, I would say, I see a very rough sea with boats on it. And you might say, well, I see something completely different. You might say, I see a field of daffodils. Oh, cool, they're yellow. So we say to this assistant in this room, excuse me, could you tell me, which of us is right here? Is this actually a rough sea with yellow boats on it, or is this actually a field of daffodils that are yellow in the springtime? And do you know what she says? She says, well, it could be both. This picture is what you want it to be. This picture has no objective meaning. This picture is random. It's absurd. This painting was actually purposeless. There it is. Or let's just think of what's happening in the concert hall in London, as we're in the Tate Modern. And in this concert hall, they are playing a piece of music by John Cage. And the orchestra comes out, you see, and there they are all sitting there, and the conductor comes out, and here he is with his baton, and he's got everybody ready, and everyone's in silence. And nothing happens for 4 minutes 13 seconds. Because John Cage's composition is 4 minutes 13 seconds of utter and total silence. Mind you, better in my view than if we were actually listening to music he did write. Do you know how he wrote it? He rolled dice. And depending on what number came up on the dice, that was the note that he put on his score. So I remember my music teacher at school, his name was Andrew Mitchell, and I still remember him to this day. He thought the avant-garde music of John Cage was absolutely wonderful. Do you know what it was? It was a clashing row. It was full of dissonance. It was full of sounds that jarred the one to the other. And no surprising, because John Cage composed his music by throwing dice. Actually, John Cage said, it's a good job he didn't apply the same principles when he went out and did his favourite hobby, which was collecting mushrooms. Because he said, if I just applied the same principles to my collection of mushrooms, I'd soon be dead, because there'd be enough toadstools with the mushrooms to kill him off pretty sharpish. Anyway, why do people paint like that? Why do people compose music like that? Because of atheistic and evolutionary philosophy. Now remember, evolutionary philosophy, evolution, is not dissociated from everyday life and behaviour. Listen again to what Richard Dawkins said. He said that evolution is blind chance working on purposeless matter. He said that therefore everything in our universe is random. Everything in our universe is absurd. Everything is purposeless. Everything is meaningless. Listen to an atheist by the name of George Gaylord Simpson. This is what he said. Man is the result of a purposeless and natural process that did not have him in mind. But damning beyond all things is a quotation I have of William Provine, Professor of History and Biological Sciences at Cornell University. Listen to what he says. He says there are no gods, no purposes, no goal-directing forces of any kind. There is no life after death. There is no foundation to ethics. There is no meaning to life. He says the universe cares nothing for us, and we have no ultimate meaning in life. As you're standing in the Tate Modern with me, and as you're looking at that picture, and as you see that it's a thing of total purposelessness and without meaning, and as you see that kind of art comes from a totally atheistic and evolutionary philosophy, ask yourself this question. Is that true to my life? Is it true to my life? Do I as a human being have no purpose? Do I have no meaning? Do I have no consciousness? Do I not have goals to which I am working? Is it not the case that I have ambitions? I have designs that I want to fulfill? Here is a very difficult question for the atheist. If, as the atheist says, we came from nothing and we're going nowhere, how is it that our lives are full of significance and purpose and meaning? And I want to put you that it all points to a God of purpose. That to say that everything is random does not square, it does not equate with the experience of every single person in this room tonight. What does square with our experience is this, that at the back of it all, there lies a God who is not only the great designer of our universe and everything in it, but that the living God is the God who created things and people in particular, with a purpose in view. Tell me, can meaning come out of meaninglessness? Can purpose come out of purposelessness? Can design come out of mere chance? I put to you this evening that it is not true to the realities of life as we know it to say that there is no God. Now we're going one other place in London. We're going to finish 2 minutes after nine. And it's this. We're going to the Old Bailey. The Old Bailey. A little while ago I sat in Lewis Crown Court down in Sussex where I live. And there was a case being heard in the court that hit the national headlines. It was a case of a man by the name of Andrew Ragg. He was an SAS, ex-SAS, had come back from security duties in Iraq, and he was charged with the murder of his 10-year-old son who suffered from Hunter syndrome. You may well have read it in the newspapers. I sat one day, a whole day, in court, and listened to Andrew Ragg give an account of how he killed his son. It was not in dispute, he killed his son. Now, in due course, he was cleared of murder. But I heard him as he gave his evidence. And I sat and thought. I saw the judge, I saw the jury, I heard the witnesses. I saw the lawyers, there they were, wigs and gowns. I saw the people in the public, I saw the prison officers, I saw the police officers, and I saw them all there. And I said to myself, this is a remarkable thing. If in fact there is no God, and if in fact there is no design, if everything is by chance, and if everything is purposeless and meaningless, and without meaning, then it cannot be the case that there are absolute rights and absolute wrongs. In other words, for morality, there needs to be an absolute reference point. And unless we get the absolute reference point, then the best that we have on everything else is mere personal opinion. Now, I do want us to follow this. You see, if there's no God, no absolute reference point, no infinite God, no eternal God, then what we call wrong isn't wrong at all. And what we call right is not right at all. Because if there's no absolute reference point for morality, there is neither right nor wrong. Everything becomes mere opinion. And yet you know and I know that deep within every person I've ever met, there is a very deep sense of what is right and what is wrong. Mind you, we know what is right without necessarily the power to do it, and we know what is wrong without the power to avoid it. But nevertheless, there is within every, even a child. See the children here tonight? Listen to what they say in the playground. Before they get to the playground, listen to what they say to their mum when she's cross with them without due cause. They say, it's not fair. That whole sense of fairness, that whole sense of justice, which is an inbuilt thing, which comes from this whole notion of right and wrong in our world. Now I want to ask you a question. Is it possible that Stalin and Lenin were not wrong, absolutely wrong, when they killed 55 million people between them? Tell me this. Was Mao Zedong not absolutely wrong when he killed an estimated 75 million people in the land of China? If there's no God, there's no way we can say he's wrong. All we can say is, very unfortunate for those who died. This fits in with evolutionary theory, survival of the fittest, survival of the strongest, bad luck for the weak. Is it possible that Pol Pot was not absolutely wrong when he killed 2 million people in 18 months in Cambodia? Is it possible that Adolf Hitler was not absolutely wrong in pursuing the aims that he had in warring his warfare in the Second World War, which resulted in the deaths of 6 million Jews in the gas chambers and 55 million people estimated worldwide? Is there anyone who could really say that wasn't absolutely wrong? That it, as a matter of absolute wrongness, that was wrong? And is it possible that I put to you that there's no such thing as that which is absolutely right? Deep within us, we all of us know that there is right and wrong. And I'm submitting to you this evening that the only way in which there is right and wrong in our universe is to make allowance for the fact that there is an absolute reference point for morality, and that absolute reference point is God. In fact, an atheist speaking on morality in these terms is a contradiction in terms. But this brings me to this in closing for tonight. This is really a lecture in two parts. So I do hope you're able to come back tomorrow night. Tomorrow night, by the way, we're kicking off with thinking about suffering and the silence of God. Two objections that actually come to us who are Christians relative to the existence of God. But this brings me to this point as I close, which is the biggest question of all for us tonight to consider, which is this. In the Bible, I recommend you to read the Bible. Maybe some of you don't read the Bible. Maybe we all don't read the Bible like we could or like we should. But I recommend the reading of the Bible. Now, up there in the city of Aberdeen, a man was told, you ought to read your Bible. He'd never read the Bible. He was actually a Muslim. He'd never read the Bible, and he didn't have one. So he pulled it up on the internet. This is what he said. I have never read a book like this. This is a living book. And he began to read the Bible, and through the reading of the Bible, he became a Christian. That was just Christmas a year ago. In Acts 17 in the Bible, Paul is speaking to a whole lot of people who did not know the living God. They did not know him to be who he is. They had absolutely no recognition of him. This is what they had. An altar that said to the unknown God. And as it was that they worshipped the unknown God, Paul, the early Christian preacher and apostle, he goes to them and this is what he says. He says, whom you ignorantly worship, him I declare unto you. And the point of the matter that Paul was saying is this. That God actually is the great creator. The fact of our existence is pointing to the fact that there is a creator God. That he is there. And that everything in our lives actually experientially points to the fact of the existence of a mighty creator, a mighty designer, not blind, purposeless chance working on matter over time, but the great creator God. But the point that Paul is making as he's speaking to the Athenians is this, that the great creator is actually the judge of all. And that one day we shall all of us be called to account. Listen to what he says to these people in Athens. He says, God now commandeth all men everywhere to repent, because he's appointed a day in which he will judge the world in righteousness. And God has given assurance of that fact in that he's raised Christ from the dead. So where I'm stopping tonight is this. If it is that God exists, and I sincerely believe that God exists, if it is that God exists, and I submit to you that evidence everywhere points to the fact of the existence of God, if you don't believe in the existence of God, my question to you is this, where is your evidence? If it is that God exists, and he's the creator, we will need to recognize that he is also the judge. That as human beings, we actually have all of us broken his laws. We have transgressed his commandments. We have done what we shouldn't have done according to his absolute moral law. We have not done what we should have done according to his moral law. And that this attracts the judgment of God, actually, ultimately. But that God has intervened in the history of our race. I want to expand on that tomorrow. God has intervened in the history of our race. And he's intervened in order that he might provide a means whereby people can be reconciled to the eternal God, from whom sin in their lives has alienated them. And that involved the coming into the world of the Son of God. His death upon Calvary's cross as the great sacrifice for sins, and his resurrection from the dead. And further, as a result, God now commands all of us to repent, to do an about turn, to cease from godless thinking and ways and activity, and to do an about turn and to acknowledge that God is indeed the creator and the judge, and that we're accountable to him. And it would be a good outcome from these two nights if it was to be the case that we took stock of where we are in our lives, and in fact, we turned to Him. We trust in that God will bless this time together to us all. I too hope it's made us think, made us to see that all the evidence actually points another way from the way in which it's thrust upon us. And we do trust that God will bless you all. I want to close by reminding you of a verse in the Bible. It says this: "The fool has said in his heart, there is no God." The Bible uses the word fool in a very sparing manner. The fool has said in his heart, there is no God. Foolish to say there is no God, because to say there is no God, you would need to know absolutely every fact that there is to know in the universe. Because if you didn't know all of those facts, the one fact that you didn't know might be the fact that God exists. The fool has said in his heart, there is no God. It isn't, as I close, it isn't a matter of intellect or intellectual activity or attainment that says there is a God or no God. It is a matter of the will. It is to do with the will as to whether or not a person believes in God. And remember that the person who comes to God must believe that He is.